funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I've hung a plaque next to my desk at every place I've worked. It's a quote attributed to Calvin Coolidge, and since he lived before the age of YouTube, I've asked my colleague Sam Baker to read it for us.
Nothing in this world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. And education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent.
Angela Duckworth might go one better than President Coolidge. To that omnipotent persistence and determination, she would add passion. Together, they equal good old-fashioned grit. And she's determined that Coolidge was on the right track. Grit has at least as much to do with success as innate talent or intelligence. The good news is we can cultivate grit. Angela Duckworth is professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and a 2013 MacArthur Fellow. Her new book is called Grit, the Power of Passion and Perseverance. Angela, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So you have a really interesting backstory here. Tell us about how you recognized the extraordinary role of grit in success.
Well, I think I can date this in some ways back to my childhood when I, you know, was growing up with a dad who talked a lot about achievement and liked to compare Einstein to Newton and ask the question, you know, which was the greater genius. I've had a lifelong fascination with what really does account for people doing what they do in their lives. But more recently, I was a teacher, and in math classrooms where I was trying to get kids to learn, you know, algebra and fractions, I could see that there were differences in the ability of my students to pick up new concepts. So I do believe that such a thing as talent exists, as your quote suggests that it does. But just as the quote implies, it's no guarantee that people will work as hard and as long as they need to accomplish things with their talent. And I think that set me on the trail of becoming a psychologist to really understand effort, the quality and the quantity of our effort put to the tasks we care about.
Can you tell in a casual conversation, a casual meeting with someone who has grit and who doesn't?
I really don't think I can, and I know that some would disagree with me. I've interviewed CEOs who insist that they can interview for grit, but I myself don't know how I would figure out whether someone is going to get up the next day early in the morning and be the first one to work to, you know, ask, how can I get better than I was yesterday? I don't know how I could tell in a short interaction whether that person would be resilient, who, you know, maybe they have something that goes wrong and they make a mistake. You know, how will they bounce back from that? And then finally, I think one of the things I find so interesting about gritty individuals is their passion. The fact that, you know, they think about the things that they're working on long past the, you know, hour of 5 o'clock in the evening when they're supposed to go home. And I wonder how in a short interaction I could, you know, ask whether this person not only had an occupation, but a preoccupation.
Do we discover passion or build it?
You know, I think the verb that we often use when we think about passion is discover or follow. And that, I think, maybe gives us the wrong idea. And the idea that, you know, we kind of find this thing fully formed, like under a rock or something, you know.
Oh, here
like,
it is.
It's just,
right.
Yeah, here it is. And I, you know, where have you been all my life? I think that's naive. I think that if you actually look at the formation of people's callings, there are two things that really make up a calling. One is to find it intrinsically interesting, the kind of thing that you would think about whether you are paid to think about it or not. And the second is to find that it has purpose, to find that, you know, what you do is not only interesting, but it's important. It matters to the lives of other people. And that's actually the most profound way that something can be important. You know that what you do matters and influences other people. Now, where do these things emerge in our lives? Well, it's over time. You know, interests take sometimes years to develop fully, and for sure, a sense of purpose, you know, that often comes at the last stage of developing a calling. And so I think that when young people around now who are graduating worry that they don't have a passion, I think that the first advice to give them is that they're not merely in a moment in time discovered.
Grit, Angela, is one of those words that can mean different things to different people. How did you settle on the definition that applies to the research that you do?
I was interviewing high achievers in different fields, people who were outstanding athletes, people who were outstanding, you know, in the private sector, entrepreneurs. And I was looking at as many different fields as I could to see what these high achievers would have in common. And when I interviewed them, not only about their own success, but about the people that they themselves most admired, these two themes, you know, tenacity in effort, which the Calvin Coolidge quote kind of gets to, but also a kind of consistency in their interest, you know, not just determination, but also a constancy in direction. And that led me to say, look, these two things, these two qualities of stamina, together we can call them grit.
How does grit differ from the big five trait of conscientiousness?
I could say that, you know, for those listeners who are familiar with personality research in the last 50 years, psychologists have kind of mapped personality into five big families. Conscientiousness is one, agreeableness is another, neuroticism, openness to experience, and extroversion. But nobody would say that there are only five ways that people are different from each other. These are five big families, and in each family there are narrower traits. Grit falls into the conscientiousness family more than any other, but there are other members of that family, like self-control, which I also study, or dependability, and just liking to be orderly and neat as opposed to being messy. So I would argue that grit is a member of this bigger, broader family. And it is, I should mention, that the family of personality traits that seems to be most reliably predictive of positive life outcomes.
Is it possible to objectively measure grit in another person?
I think it is, but we should hasten to add, I should hasten to add, as somebody who does this for a living, that when scientists say that we can measure something, we're not saying that we can measure it perfectly, that we can measure it without error. I use a grit scale, which is just a questionnaire you can fill out about yourself and people can fill it out about you. It asks questions like whether you are a hard worker, whether you finish what you begin, how constant your interests have been or your commitments have been over years. Now, that, I think, gives you some indication of grit, but it's not a perfect measure. You can certainly fake it, and you can be a little delusional. You might think you have more grit than you think because you have lower standards.
So I was poking around online with your grit scale, and it occurred to me that the answers that I would give today at 45 with four kids to take care of and a household and a job, it's really different. Those are really different than the answers I might have given you at 20 when I was still sort of figuring things out. Is that common for the level of grit we have to change?
Yeah, and might I probe a bit and ask you, do you feel like you would be grittier today than if you had taken the same exact questionnaire, say, 20 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
I can say the same for myself, and I'm 46 today, and if I took the scale when I was half my age, I would say, gosh, my interests being consistent over years, I'm still figuring out what I want to do. And I think I was a hard worker, but I think I'm a harder worker now, mm-hmm. and I for sure am more resilient. You know, I think that in the data that I've collected, if you look at people in their 20s, they are the millennials, right? They're really at the bottom of the barrel in terms of my data on grit compared to the 30-year-olds in the sample or the 40 and the 50-year-olds. And the question is, what's going on there? Now, older adults like to tell me that the millennials grew up without all the life lessons and the stories of hard work and patience that they did. But really, if you look at the preponderance of psychological data that have been collected on change in things like grit, mostly it favors a maturation hypothesis, the idea that you get better or you learn with time and with experience.
That's comforting, right? Because remember, Angela, they said this about us, the Gen X kids, that we had no discipline, that we were drifting, that we were lazy, and we turned out okay. I think the millennials will be just fine.
Yeah, I think each generation likes to sort of beat up a little bit on the next generation. You know, one thing to keep in mind when that 20-something is annoying you with their, you know, work habits or their lack of direction is that, you know, oftentimes we have twice, if not three times as much life experience. So, you know, maybe they just haven't grown up yet.
Okay, so all this being said, I think it makes perfect sense. And yet, lots of people are looking at your research and that of other colleagues that you have in the field and saying, we need to put this into school curricula. How is that possible? And what are the sort of caveats that you would include before a school tried to instill a grit program?
Yeah, I first would like to say that there is no such thing as a grit curriculum, you know, not one that I have, not one that I know that anyone else has. And this isn't to say that teachers shouldn't do anything, that they should sit on their hands. I mean, what great teachers do is they take anything that they learn about and they ask, you know, how can that make my classroom better? How can it make my students more successful? So I don't want to dampen the enthusiasm of teachers. But at the same time, I think it's naive to think that you could fully cultivate a quality like grit in some kind of self-contained, you know, click here, download this PDF, all of a sudden your kids are going to get grittier. For one thing, as Paul Tough's new book, I should note, points out, you know, the environment that a kid exists in, you know, how supportive it really is, how secure that child feels about the future. Well, that's going to influence grit, because if you don't really think you can depend on anybody in your life, why would you be resilient? That would make no sense. At the same time, in my own data, I see that kids from disadvantage, you know, they have less access to things like sports teams and ballet class, musical training. And I think in these activities, they not only express their grit, they develop their grit. And so there are many reasons to think that a curriculum alone, if it ever existed, won't be enough. I'll just add this. Now, at the end of the day, you could say, well, now what are you saying to teachers about Monday morning? And here's what I would say. I think it's very powerful to learn about things like grit and growth mindset, other aspects of character like curiosity. What does the science say? And then if teachers want to work on ways to incorporate that into their instruction, absolutely, but not because poverty doesn't matter, not because support overall doesn't matter, only because, as any good teacher knows, that those things just help to contribute to a positive classroom culture and climate.
Hmm. Does grit compensate for socioeconomic hardship in kids? You taught in some schools with a lot of students who had not had advantages. Did you see that grit would help some of them overcome challenges?
You know, I think that when I here's my answer. I do think that it's helpful to be a kid who is passionate and who has the skills and the habits of perseverance. But I don't want it to sound like I think it can compensate in that, okay, well, now it doesn't matter that you don't have a home to go to or that there isn't a stable adult in your life. You know, nothing could be farther from the truth. So, for example, when I study people like Cody Coleman, this is a kid who emailed me out of the blue. He had seen my TED talk, I think, and he was just on the cusp of graduating from MIT with a nearly perfect grade point average in electrical engineering and computer science. In his email, he described, you know, a classic resilience story, you know, coming out of total chaos and disadvantage and really rising above that to be successful. I do study people like Cody Coleman because I want to know whether there's a lesson that can be generalized for the rest of us. But it's not because I want kids to grow up in those circumstances, nor would he. And when you really dig a little deeper, you find that there were a series of individuals in his life who took care of him, who looked out for him, who gave him encouragement when he didn't have any himself. So I think the question of disadvantage and poverty is a complex one. But I don't think that the answer for policymakers or educators is that this gives us license to ignore those things. On the contrary, it only throws into high relief how very important they are.
My guest is Angela Duckworth, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and a 2013 MacArthur Fellow. Her new book is called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with a psychology professor, Angela Duckworth. She teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and does research there. She received a MacArthur Fellowship a few years ago, and she's done a TED Talk. Her new book is called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. You can join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, in extolling the virtues of grit, we might accidentally ignore the fact that for some people, like, you could use up all your grit, say, getting to school or getting to work on a typical day, whereas somebody else who has fewer hardships might spend that grit becoming a star debater or a math champion. How can we be sure that, where grit exists, we can help young people to really use it in ways that will be productive later on?
I think it's an excellent point to bring up. And maybe I'll just say, by way of thinking, introducing the way I think about this. A few years ago, I started a nonprofit called the Character Lab, and I did it as a partnership between myself, a scientist, and educators. We got together because we wanted to know, is there something that a school could do to encourage, well, not only grit, but things like curiosity and emotional intelligence, all the things that we would want all children, no matter who they are, to grow up to have. And I think that in conversations with these educators, some of whom work with the poorest kids that we have in our country, they would say exactly what you pointed out, which is, before 8 a.m, the number of obstacles, the number of challenges that these kids are dealing with, they're unimaginable, really, and they're invisible to some of us from the outside. So what do we do about that? How do we figure out who's really dealing with these things? How do we give them proper credit for it? But I think the most urgent question that the educators have brought up is, if these kids have skills to get over setbacks that, we didn't have to deal with maybe in our own lives growing up, how do we get them to generalize that so that, for example, they can finish things like college, which the statistics show for lower income kids, our dropout rates are the highest in the world for college completion. So I guess my feeling is this. I think that it's not at all a problem just of kids in these situations. Human beings are not, spontaneously able to generalize skills and habits from one domain to another. There are studies that are more than a century old in psychology showing that when we develop a skill in one domain, it doesn't spontaneously transfer to another. So if a kid has been tremendously resilient in overcoming a chaotic family life, they might need some help in transferring that skill to their first tough year in college, being maybe academically challenged in ways that they haven't been or feeling like they don't belong. So I think there's a lot of work to be done, but maybe the first place to start is just a position of empathy and respect for what kids are going through.
What do you recommend for people whose passions don't happen to gel with what the world values or what is taught in school or what is required on the job?
Sometimes people ask me, well, what if your passion is Minecraft? And apparently you can, if you're in a very, very small number of people, you're able to get a job playing video games professionally. And people often will bring that up. And I like to point out, well, that's not most people. And so I think there is a real practical matter. When I was growing up, my dad emphasized to me that he was never asked to choose what he did for a living. His own father, this is my grandfather, assigned him chemistry because the family was in the textile business and they needed somebody to make the dyes prettier for the fabrics that they were producing. So my dad liked to emphasize to me the practical realities of earning a living and paying the bills. I think that's absolutely correct. You don't have to consider that this is only a blank piece of paper where you don't have to worry about things like retirement and making a living. But at the same time, the data are very, very strong on the question of whether your interests matter. If you look at data on thousands of adults who have declared what their interests are and then, for example, been rated by their supervisors for performance, it's clear that people thrive, they perform better, and they're happier when their interests align with what they do for a living. So I would say that within the bounds of things that you could actually get paid for, there's lots of room for most of us to find things that we are intrinsically interested in as well.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Andre on the line in Frisco. Hi, Andre.
Hello. I was curious if Angela's work complements or is complemented by the work by a colleague of yours at the University of Pennsylvania, I believe, Dr. Martin Seligman, on positivity. Particularly, does one beget the other? If you practice more positivity, does that beget grit, or does grit create positivity in you?
Well, I happen to know a lot about this question, in part because Marty Seligman's office is only a few steps from my office and because he was my PhD advisor. So now we're colleagues. Marty's work on positive psychology in the last decade or two has really, I think, influenced me insofar as, you know, he's very interested in trying to understand and explore life that's worth living. You know, it's a very ancient project, but he's applying the scientific method to it. His and my research suggests that happiness and grit are very correlated. In other words, if you have a high grit score, you're much more likely than not to be happy, to be satisfied with your life, and to experience a lot of positive emotion. That doesn't mean that being happy makes you gritty, or that your grit makes you happy. It could be that you just have a life that encourages both, you know, some circumstance. But at a minimum, it suggests that grit doesn't come at the expense of your happiness. And my suspicion is that having a positive outlook, you know, being an optimist, looking for what you can change, not being obsessed with what you can't change, the sorts of things that Marty's devoted his life to, my strong suspicion is that we're going to find causal evidence that, in fact, that does contribute to being persistent. And already there is some, but there needs to be more research than there is now.
You've talked about the importance of a growth mindset as opposed to a fixed mindset. The idea, not that you are inherently able or unable to do certain things, but that you can cultivate your abilities with hard work. Are certain cultures then grittier than others based on whether they generally value the fixed or growth mindsets?
Yeah, you're referring to the work of my colleague Carol Dweck. She's at Stanford University, and she has developed the idea. Now it's pervasive, not only in psychology, but I think in education and, frankly, the corporate world as well, that we could have either a growth mindset theory of human nature that says that abilities are really things that grow and that develop with experience, with effort, or we could have a fixed mindset, a theory that we're kind of who we are and there's no sense in trying to change ourselves. What Carol and I find in our joint work is that people with a growth mindset, be they young people or fully grown adults, they're the ones who are grittier. And I would say, linking it up to maybe the previous comment, that if you ask the question, why do some people fixate on things that they can't change and sort of give up easily in the face of adversity? Well, Carol would say maybe their theory of how the world works is really oriented towards fixed, unchangeable qualities as opposed to growth. So I believe that growth mindset is really the foundation of an outlook that encourages you to keep working even when things go wrong. And our data support that.
Are gritty people more focused on the future than the average person? Exceptionally gritty people?
I think that exceptionally gritty people are looking to the future in the sense that they have these like far off goals. And some people that I've interviewed don't even think they're ever going to achieve them. It's just the striving, really. It's the journey, to use a cliche that I can't think of a better way of expressing, you know, that that's more important than the destination. So they really are looking forward. You know, one of the people that I talked to when I was researching the book is named Hester Lacey. She's a British journalist. And every week, she interviews a super achiever from all walks of life, you know, chocolatiers to, you know, the person who created Wikipedia. And she's found that one thing they all have in common is this kind of tremendous forward-looking optimism. For example, she says, these people are always looking to get better, but it's not like they're looking at the past with regret. They're looking forward with energy and enthusiasm.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Actually, we will hang out and go back to the phones in a couple of minutes. Does grit tend to manifest itself in any different way depending on sex? Are boys and girls gritty in exactly the same ways?
You know, I've been asked that question. I looked at my own data for whether I see any real pattern, any real difference. I don't know that there is, you know, much to say about girls and boys or men and women differently expressing their grit. Of course, this doesn't mean that everybody has the same interests. But I would say that, you know, men and women in general, if you look at psychological data, are more similar than they're different. I mean, there are gender differences, but there's a lot of overlap between the way that men and women operate.
How can parents recognize school programs that are more likely to cultivate grit than others that they may have to choose from?
One thing that as a mom, and I did this in collaboration with my husband, of course, we asked the question of our own two girls who are now teenagers. They're 13 and 14. You know, what can we do to encourage grit through their activities? And we basically decided that everybody in our family would have to do something hard. And we had a specific definition for hard. In our family, a hard thing is something that requires deliberate practice. This is the kind of practice that scientific research has shown experts engage in when they want to build their skill. They work on something, maybe it's even a small aspect of their overall performance, but it has to be something challenging that they can't yet do. They concentrate 100%. They get feedback on what they did right, and they get feedback on what they did incorrectly that they could do better. And then they start the whole process all over again, reflecting on what that feedback means and trying to, again, do that accomplish that challenging goal just a little bit better than they had the last time. That's what it means to do a hard thing. And as a parent, you can ask, well, where can my daughter or my son learn that? It's often in a sport. It could be through a musical instrument. It could be in community service, maybe older kids tutoring younger kids. They can do that at actually relatively young ages. I think in any discipline where you are encouraged to learn and grow, and you have a coach often or a teacher, these are the things that I think a parent can look for as ways of building grit through kids' activities.
We have a tweet here from Randy who wants to know, is grit in any sense a way to describe an exceptional work ethic?
I think that work ethic is part of grit for sure. And actually, one of the psychologists who has studied this has called it learned industriousness. He did experiments on rats and also on people showing that you could actually teach, for example, a rat to work harder by rewarding it for effort. And contrary-wise, he would say that if you reward a rat, for example, for just kind of a half-hearted effort, you know, low effort, but you reward the rat the same way, well, then you're reinforcing laziness. So I think that to some extent, work ethic, you know, learning to work hard for things, learning that effort's not a terrible thing. That's a part of grit, but I think it's incomplete because what if you have this work ethic, but you don't have something that you think is interesting or meaningful to you, that you feel like it has purpose? Then I think you don't have grit.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Jeremy on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for having me on the show. Mm-hmm. I had a quick comment. I think it's good for in a work area for your boss or supervisor or even staff to tell you that you are doing a good job because it makes you feel better. And then you feel more interested in your job as opposed to like you working hard and you don't get recognition for your hard work.
Well, I am I love encouragement. My own daughter, Lucy, once said to me, and she was actually fairly young, but she turned to me one day and she said, Mom, you know what everybody wants? And I said, no, Lucy, what does everybody want? And she said, praise. We all love to be praised. Maybe she'll grow up to be a psychologist because that's actually the same thing that Adam Smith, the great economist and observer of human nature, said. Mm. He said, we all want to be praised and to be praiseworthy. So I think encouragement is fundamental to keeping our motivation up. At the same time, I don't think we have to overpraise. You know, we don't have to tell people that they're perfect or that, you know, everybody's a winner. But absolutely, we all need encouragement, and I do. In fact, I need it daily.
When you were working with school children, I wonder what you did with the ones that you thought had a great deal of potential intellectually who just didn't seem engaged with the material. Obviously, that's the job of the teacher, and yet there's some intrinsic motivation is impossible to give to someone else.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that nobody's interested in everything and everybody's interested in something. So, you know, the goal of education shouldn't be to, you know, cookie cutter style stamp out kids who are identical in what they like to do. That's not good for the economy either. Of course, you can't say to a second grader, well, it turns out you don't like math. Well, at the age of eight, you know, you can sign yourself out of math class. I mean, obviously, there are requirements and kids do have to sometimes do things that they find tedious. I would say that as a teacher, maybe the most effective thing that I did was to just model for them how exciting and interesting it could be. These days, I teach statistics to actually adults who have already gotten their bachelor's degrees. Some of these people are in their 60s. And in the beginning of the class, they write to me letters and they tell me how they feel about the upcoming statistics class. And some of them tell me that they're terrified of balancing their checkbook. But I try to show them through my own example how very wonderful statistics can be. And I'll tell you that by the end of the class, some of the people who thought they would never be interested in a regression model are just delighted that they've discovered this. And the last thing I'll say about this is recently had a conversation with Larry King. Now, Larry King is not somebody that you would say, I bet his favorite class in school was algebra. But he tells me that the teacher who made the greatest impression on him was his math teacher, because though he didn't become a mathematician, though math isn't his strongest subject, that teacher was so enthusiastic that Larry never forgot it. It's been a lifelong memory for him to know what it's like to get interested in something because there's a caring adult who's so wonderfully excited about it themselves.
How does grit relate to creativity and creative pursuits?
You know, I don't find that having imagination, you know, your kind of divergent thinking, like, well, what if we put this crayon together with this other, you know, piece of string? What could happen? I don't find that it's highly correlated with grit. In other words, grit isn't the same thing as being a creative and imaginative person. Now, at the same time, I would say that to truly create something valuable, you know, to make a work of art or to come up with a piece of software that's going to improve people's productivity, that does, of course, require that you work on it. And so, you know, creativity and grit are different, but in some ways they both contribute to creative achievement.
Angela Duckworth is my guest. She's professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Angela Duckworth, a 2013 MacArthur Fellow, a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of the book Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Angela, in your chapter on practice, I really like the fact that you explained that even very gritty individuals don't necessarily always find practice fun. They may have a passion and recognize that they are building towards something, but it's not as if it doesn't feel like a grind sometimes. And this is important to remember, because I think some people may have passion and they may have, you know, a perseverant spirit, but they think they don't because they assume they should be enjoying every minute of it.
That's exactly right. I remember distinctly talking to Rowdy Gaines, who won the gold medal in the 1984 Olympics for the 100-meter free. And I asked him, well, Rowdy, you must love to practice swimming because you swam so much. And he said, well, I think I roughly swam around the circumference of the globe in preparation for, you know, 20,000 miles or thereabouts in preparation for those Olympics. But, you know, if you're asking me whether I like to wake up in the, you know, early morning hours when it's dark outside, slip into a Speedo, you know, walk to the pool, jump in the water, and then swim till my heart is, you know, jumping out of my chest, and then do it again the next. You know, he said, I had a passion for the overall sport. I had a passion for being that healthy and in shape at the top of my game. I had the passion for my teammates. I had a passion for swimming as an endeavor, but I don't know that I would have passion at 4:30 in the morning for swimming practice. Now, that said, I would hasten to add, some people, and they're in the minority, insist to me that almost everything they do is playful and flow-like. So there is a difference of opinion. The majority of people will say, however, that there are at least parts of what they do to get better that are tedious, that are frustrating, that are difficult.
You said flow-like, and you're referring to Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's state of flow, which is where time sort of disappears and you're just in the zone.
That's exactly right. It's where experts say challenge and skill just meet. So yes, it's very challenging, but they have the skills to achieve that. In practice, oftentimes the challenge exceeds the skill. You're doing something you can't yet do fluently. I think that's really the difference. Overall, what I find is that practice is oftentimes arduous and difficult, but performance can be flow-like.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Frank on the line in Duncanville. Hi, Frank.
Oh, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I was listening to what you said about your daughter and how she said that people are actually seeking praise. Isn't that kind of like a biblical question or a biblical response?
You might know better than I do. I don't know the Bible as well as I should. But I think that, you know, that's an observation about human nature, really, you know, and I think you could probably find some allusion to it in liturgical texts of other traditions as well. I think what Adam Smith meant when he said that we are all seeking to gain praise from others and to be praiseworthy is that, you know, there is something about us that's wired for encouragement. And it's the rare individual, maybe there aren't any individuals who would say that they really don't need any positive feedback on what they're doing.
Early in life, and you mentioned this earlier, many of us are still trying to figure out what it is that we do have a passion for. What do you suggest to people when they are at that point where they're not quite certain what absolutely captures their attention, but they are hoping to, you know, build themselves into someone that does have a passion?
I can identify with that myself. When I was 22, I wouldn't have told you that I would grow up to be a psychological scientist. I didn't know that then. It was a struggle, and I am so glad I'm not in my 20s anymore because, you know, those were hard years to not know where I was going. The most important thing, I think, is to hypothesis test. In other words, get some data, try it. You know, one of the things that I see as a professor teaching 18 to 22-year-olds who are terrified of leaving school because for the first time in their lives, they have to actually decide what to do and not just figure out how to do it well. I think the most important thing is take as many chances as possible to test those hypotheses. If you think you might want to be a veterinarian, go spend a day with one. If you think you might want to have a radio show, see what that's like. I think the most important thing is that it's a trial and error kind of endeavor. It's messy. It's a little bit inefficient. You got to get started.
As parents and teachers and coaches and first employers for young people, surely we want to encourage grit. But are there things that we do and say, Angela, that maybe inadvertently undermines grit?
Well, maybe one little piece of advice I would give for the millennials in their first job is that though part of your job is to self-actualize, to grow as a person, to figure out what you yourself want to do, I think that millennials invariably come into their first jobs with that in mind. That's kind of been what they've done for the first, you know, 18 or 22 years of their life. I think you also have to recognize that you've made a commitment to your employer. And so though self-actualization is something that you should definitely try to do, you should also fulfill your responsibilities. And if, for example, you take a job and you promise your manager that you will be there for 2 years, that if, you know, circumstances would allow it, like, please do that. Finish what you begin. Do as excellent a job as you can. Learn as much as possible. If after that commitment you decide this isn't for you, then then move on to something else. But I think it's a very good habit to have to finish our commitments and to carry through on those responsibilities that affect other people.
All right, I want to talk about delaying gratification. Are the grittiest people the best at this?
I also study self-control, which is a cousin of grit. It's also in the conscientiousness family that you mentioned earlier, this broader family. Now, I think the ability to delay gratification, to rein in our impulses, to manage our emotions, to control our attention, it's a tremendously important competency. And in fact, I do find that grittier individuals, on average, have more self-control than others. But the correlation's not perfect, and that means that there are some very gritty people who don't have complete mastery over their impulses. And I know quite a few successful people who are like that. I think the difference is this. If you have lined up your life such that you really are doing something that more or less is your favorite thing to do, you don't actually have a lot of conflicts about whether you should do that thing or something else. If you really line up your passions and you are lucky enough to be able to do that, then I think really grit ends up becoming more important for high achievement. Maybe not staying on your diet or, you know, getting good grades in school, things that you're less passionate about, but the one thing in your life that you would say, yes, this is the most meaningful. That's where grit really operates.
This may sound like a funny question. I don't remember seeing it in the book, but do people with a lot of grit do better in relationships than people without?
You know, I don't know for sure. I have very little data on that. It's been a hypothesis that has been suggested to me by more than one person. And, you know, I'm married and I love my husband more than life itself. But has it always been easy? No. Do we get along in every respect? No. So there's a little bit of perseverance there, I think, at least speaking for myself. I would say that, you know, relationships are so complicated. And the reason I'm hesitant is that you would never want to tell someone, oh, just be gritty and stay with that terrible relationship. You know, that would really be kind of ridiculously bad advice. That said, I think relationships do require effort, you know, any relationship, not just romantic ones, but friendship and being a good daughter or being a good mom as well.
We have an email here from Kathy in Fort Worth who says, I have a 17-year-old high school student who has a passion for playing the trumpet. He's known for years he'll pursue music as a career. He has worked hard for his significant accomplishments. You were discussing maturity as a factor in grit, but he definitely fits the definition when playing the trumpet. He is not particularly disciplined in other ways. I'm wondering if this is unusual or do you see this kind of grit discrepancy in young people?
Almost by definition, you can't be gritty about everything. I mean, what would it mean to pursue everything with passion and perseverance? There aren't enough hours in the day and there are not enough days in the week. I think what it means to be gritty is to be passionate and persevering about something. So if your son is passionate about music, but doesn't seem to be passionate about putting their clothes in the hamper or, you know, getting their English homework done, it's not to say that they shouldn't put their clothes in the hamper or shouldn't get their English worked up. But I think I'm not at all surprised. And in the very long run, I think that most of us are rewarded in life for becoming specialists. So for me, if my daughters end up doing one thing that they love very, very well, but end up not being great at some other things, as long as they're not getting in the way of life functioning or harming others, for me, that's okay.
You've said that your father would tell you when you were a kid, Angela, you're no genius, which, you know, out of context sounds like a terrible thing to say, but he meant that as an encouragement.
You know, I think my dad, more than anything else, was probably speaking out loud about himself as much as he was talking about me. He didn't think he was a genius. He thought he was very smart. He liked to think that he was, you know, a very far above average intelligence, but he wouldn't put himself in the stratosphere. You know, maybe what I took out of that was that my father was very interested one way or the other in how smart we all were, you know, how we would line up if he ranked us from smartest to least smart. The other thing I took from that when I spoke to my mom, you know, she had a great perspective on my dad growing up, is that, you know, to at least have some empathy for people. My dad cared so much about his own accomplishments. And I kind of figured out fairly early in life that it wasn't always about me, you know, these utterances. I also knew that he loved me. I mean, he truly cared for me. And I think the kind of context that it's so hard to describe a parent to somebody else is that, you know, you can't describe to them all those little moments when you as a child, you know, see how your parents really feel for you. And I knew my dad loved me.
grit certainly can contribute to success. Does success contribute to happiness?
I think that the evidence that, you know, being successful is a contributor to happiness, that it's one of the things that we care about, is relatively robust. And I'm thinking about research that's not just mine. Being happy also makes you higher achieving because, you know, you're energetic, you're engaged with what you're doing. But to use these terms synonymously, I think, is a mistake. You know, to be truly successful in the broadest sense of the term, for most of us, means that we have healthy relationships, that we lead a life of moral integrity, as New York Times writer David Brooks would hasten to remind us all, that it's not only important to be great in some way, it's more important to be good. So I think in so many ways, achievement is an incomplete description of success. But most of us would rather be excellent at something. And I think that's what grit's all about. Not that you have to be in the Olympics or you have to win the Nobel Prize, but I truly believe that human beings prefer to be excellent at something, and that is available to all of us.
Can too much grit get in the way of making a course correction when maybe we are pursuing something that we have a passion for, but we are not as well suited to as something else?
There was actually a recent experiment done in a lab that wasn't mine. And what the psychologists did was they looked to see whether how gritty you were would predict how long you would work on puzzles. Some of the puzzles were hard, but some of the puzzles were impossible. You couldn't solve them no matter how hard you tried. And they did find that grittier people struggled with those impossible puzzles longer than less gritty people. And that suggested that, you know, maybe there's some downside to grit. I do think that if you're stubbornly tenacious about kind of what I would call low-level goals, kind of the to-do list goals, like, oh, I need to get this specific thing done, I need to get that client to call me back, that can get you into trouble because you're missing opportunities to call some other client back who's going to be just a better customer overall. But when it comes to your high-level goals, the things that you say, look, this is who I am, this is this pursuit that could orient me for decades, it's usually something general. Like for me, I'll tell you that my highest-level goal is to use psychological science to help children thrive. There's nothing that would stop me from pursuing that. And so grit applied to your highest level life goals, I think, is almost always a good thing. Grit misapplied to very low level tactical things, I think that can get you into trouble.
Don't name names here. I'm wondering if your kids are equally gritty.
Yeah, I better not name names. Well, their names are Lucy and Amanda. I would say this. I don't have to compare them, though, right? I can just name their names and say that both Lucy. Here's what I would say about Lucy and Amanda. At 13 and 14, they strike me as well on their way to developing grit. And when they were younger than that, I worried a little bit because they would struggle and then give up on things. I'm remembering particular occasions where, you know, something was hard and they cried and they, you know, weren't willing to put in the effort. One thing that being a mom has showed me is how much children change and grow. And we shouldn't count our kids out of things. You know, we should resist the kind of fixed mindset, well, I guess you're just not an athlete, or, you know, you're never going to be a people person, that's for sure. It's that kind of outlook that is its own self-fulfilling prophecy, I think. And children are so sensitive to those beliefs that parents have.
Angela Duckworth is professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Angela, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you. I so enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.